Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think it's interesting to take a food that is so commonplace in our diet, so ubiquitous, so expected, and to cast a critical eye on it and just kind of interrogate, you know, why do we think that this is a, quote, normal thing to do?
Andrea Wiley studies the human consumption of cow's milk. Does it really help kids grow? Is dairy part of a healthy diet for adults? Wiley tells us about her research that sits at the intersection of biology, anthropology, and milk. From Harvest Public Media today, farmers and veterinarians face new rules for using antibiotics on the farm. And in the kitchen at Farm Bloomington, we're making a French sauce called a rouille, and then a no-meat taco. Glad to have our man Mark Chilla back reading headlines.
And early into 2017, Annie, there's already plenty to talk about in food news. The Organic Trade Association wants to make it easier for farmers to switch to growing organic food. Here's how it works now. Farmers have to follow organic rules for 3 years before they can sell their food as certified organic. That transition period can mean much lower profits. But a new certification, approved by the USDA this week, allows for certification for food grown during this transition period. The hope is that it will put money in farmers' pockets and encourage them to take the leap into organic certification. As NPR's Dan Charles reported, it's not clear whether this transitional food will fetch higher prices than conventional food in a supermarket. The value of this certification may lie not in the supermarket, but farther back in the supply chain. For instance, many egg producers or dairies also are interested in getting into organic production, and they're looking for new suppliers. They may pay extra for certified transitional grain if it helps them lock in a reliable supply of organic animal feed for the future. This story made headlines last week. Federal authorities have launched an investigation into the alleged embezzlement of $2.6 million from an Oklahoma nonprofit board that promotes the beef industry. An investigation by Harvest Public Media and State Impact Oklahoma shows the money came from a mandatory government program funded by farmers and ranchers. Joe Wirtz reports.
The Oklahoma Beef Council is part of a national group funded by a mandatory $1 per head checkoff fee paid each time farmers and ranchers sell an animal. The council kept the alleged embezzlement under wraps until an inquiry made by Harvest and State Impact. While criminal charges have not been filed, the council has filed a lawsuit to recover money from its former accounting and compliance manager. The National Beef Board takes in about $80 million a year with little federal oversight, which has angered some farmers and ranchers like Mike Calicrate. He says news of the embezzlement didn't surprise him because of the Beef Board's veil of secrecy.
It just adds to the suspicion that I think a lot of cattlemen have that our dollars are not being utilized in a way that actually benefits the cowboy that's paying.
The Oklahoma Beef Council refused a request for an interview. In a statement, it said it was cooperating with federal investigators and had strengthened its accounting practices. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Joe Wirtz in Oklahoma City.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced earlier this week it added the rusty-patched bumblebee to the endangered species list. Once a species that thrived along the East Coast and in the Midwest, the number of rusty-patched bumblebee colonies have fallen by almost 87% in the last 20 years. Now it's the second bee in the U.S. to be protected under federal law. The cause of the sharp decrease in bee numbers is not certain, but scientists believe disease, pesticide exposure, habitat loss, climate change, and other factors are to blame. The Portland-based Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation, which petitioned the government to list the rusty-patched bumblebee as endangered, says the bumblebee's decline may also be caused by the spread of bacteria or viruses from commercially raised bumblebees to those in the wild. Seven species of the yellow-faced bees in Hawaii were the first ever bee species declared endangered in the U.S. last year. Three other bee species, Franklin's bumblebee, the western bumblebee, and the yellow-banded bumblebee, may also be added to the endangered species list in the coming months. And the USDA has announced a two-year project that will allow some food stamp recipients to order groceries online and get food delivered to their homes. Amazon and six other companies will accept supplemental nutrition food program benefits for home delivery in seven states, including Iowa, Maryland, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Washington. The project is meant to expand access to more nutritious options at better prices, especially for people who live in so-called food deserts and the elderly and disabled recipients who lack mobility. The pilot was originally slated for launch before July last year, but the USDA ran into tech snags in making online use of SNAP cards secure and fraud-proof. The project only allows SNAP credits to be spent on eligible food items and will not include delivery fees. There's more to check out online, including a story about a link between warming waters and a dangerous neurotoxin that builds up in shellfish. The website is eartheats.org.
Yes, and Twitter and Facebook, too. Connect with us on social media. Mark Chilla, thanks.
Thank you.
Infections resistant to treatment by antibiotics can be deadly, and they're on the rise. In an effort to save some of our most crucial medicines, the federal government is imposing new rules on how antibiotics can be used to treat livestock. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the changes are minimal.
I don't know if you've noticed, there's a little bit of a sneeze in here.
Veterinarian Paul Thomas is walking through this hog barn near Otebolt, Iowa. He's not worried about the cough he hears coming from the two-month-old pigs.
You know, there's a good chance that whatever's causing that, might be viral or might be environmental. And an antibiotic in that case is not appropriate. It's not going to do anything.
And yet, the thousands of pigs here are getting antibiotics in their feed, as are many of the animals that become our pork chops and steaks. More than 21 million pounds of medically important antibiotics were sold for use in livestock in 2015, according to the most recent government data. Thomas says these recently weaned pigs are susceptible to a bacterial diarrhea.
That's predictable, and so we might use a VFD on a product to prevent that.
Is that the most recent?
A VFD, which Thomas shows me, is a veterinary feed directive. It's like a prescription. And now, they're required for all antibiotics deemed medically important to humans. For example, piglets might get penicillin for meningitis, or cattle might get treated with tetracyclines for a liver condition. Those same classes of drugs are prescribed to people for strep throat and acne. In the past, farmers could buy feed containing antibiotics at the local feed store without even consulting a vet. Not anymore.
I do think it will ensure that antibiotics are being used appropriately, and I think that's what's important.
Doctors and public health officials say overuse in people and livestock is making the medications less effective. Exposed bacteria that don't die adapt and can even become more dangerous. That's why the Food and Drug Administration developed tighter controls. Also in the new rules, giving animals antibiotics so they grow faster or bigger is no longer allowed. But farmers can still use the drugs to prevent and treat diseases. Iowa State University Extension veterinarian Chris Rodemaker says that's important, and farmers and vets are committed to appropriate use standards.
We're humans too. We understand the concern, and we think as long as we don't jeopardize animal health and well-being, we're going to do everything that we can to make sure we're using antibiotics judiciously.
I frankly am skeptical that we're going to see any drop in amount of drug used or any big shift in which particular drugs are used.
That's James Johnson, an infectious disease doctor at the University of Minnesota. And he's right. The rule changes do not call for reduction in overall antibiotic use on farms.
My concern is not that there are other ones that will be used and they'll be as big a problem. It's in fact that the air is going to hit the fan now with this thing, and really nothing is going to change.
That worries him because each year about 2 million people in this country get sick with a bacterial infection that antibiotics can't wipe out. Some 20,000 of those people die. Researchers have linked illnesses in humans to drug-resistant bacteria on the farm. But Johnson says agribusiness interests downplay the link between on-farm use, the emergence of resistance, and illness in people.
It's very clear that these high antibiotic use, intensive animal operations are great breeding grounds for resistant bacteria.
Johnson also recognizes agriculture's argument that there's limited data definitively linking on-farm antibiotic use to resistant infections in humans. The FDA declined to explain just how its new rules will reduce antibiotic resistance, but in a written statement told Harvest Public Media that it's expanding its data collection on the sale and distribution of antibiotics in hopes of better studying the link between farm use and resistance. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
More news from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. We're talking about milk today with Andrea Wiley, professor of anthropology and human biology at Indiana University. To set up the conversation, I wanted to see what recommendations the government has for our dairy consumption. So I checked out choosemyplate.gov, and here's what it says. So for 2 to 3-year-olds, it's 2 cups from the dairy group every day. Add another 1/2 cup for 4 to 8-year-olds, and then once you hit 9, the recommendations stay the same through adulthood, 3 cups of dairy per day. When Andrea Wiley was growing up, drinking a couple cups of cow's milk every day was expected and encouraged. Her mom was a school nutritionist who drove around with a Got Milk bumper sticker on her car. But then Andrea started studying biological anthropology in college, and she learned that not everyone drinks cow's milk into adulthood. Not everyone can.
When I started to learn about population variation and the ability to digest milk, it kind of raised a lot of questions for me about what I had grown up assuming about milk.
Now she's made a career of researching the human consumption of milk. For more on this, I want to hand it off to Lee Bush and Maddie Chera from Indiana University's Food Institute. Hi.
Hi, Annie. Great to be here.
Yeah.
I'm Lee.
I'm Maddie.
You'll be inviting researchers into the Earth Eat studios to talk about their work over the next several months. Pretty excited about that. And so let's talk about where we're starting today.
We had decided that we wanted to start with Andrea Wiley's research because she really enlightened us as to how milk became such an integral part of the American diet.
Yet there's some people who just can't or don't want to drink dairy milk. In fact, Andrea's own son is allergic to milk.
Okay.
There's actually a lot of conversations happening about food and diet these days. We've seen it in both research and the popular media. We're starting to understand more and more about how the foods we eat interacts with not just our physical bodies. With Andrea's research, she's also interested in finding the connections with culture, history, and our food lives.
So it's pretty well established at this point that the mutation that underlies the ability to digest the lactose in milk could spread only in populations that have histories of dairying. We now have worked out the underlying genetics of that, what specific mutations are there. There are different ones in Europe than exist in sub-Saharan African pastoralist populations. But they all have the same effect of basically keeping this enzyme that's called lactase on throughout life in most, if not, well, most mammals and most humans. That gene actually has a regulatory area next to it that turns it off early in childhood. For most mammals, it's sometime around the time of weaning, which makes good sense because mammals are never going to see milk again. But it's an unusual feature of some human populations that gene does not get turned off. It persists. This is what we call lactase persistence.
So we have a lot of lingo here, Annie, that we need to define. Lactase persistence means you have the genetic mutation that allows you to digest the lactose in milk throughout your life. The flip side of that is lactase impersistence, which should not be confused with lactose intolerance.
Okay. All right.
Right. So lactose intolerance is a biomedical diagnostic term for what happens if you drink milk and then develop uncomfortable gastrointestinal symptoms.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so that's the biology of it. Andrea also looks at the cultural side of things. In the case of milk, many, many generations ago, certain pockets of humans decided to domesticate other mammals and drink their milk.
How did that set up a new kind of evolutionary scenario that led to basically natural selection favoring the spread of lactase persistence in populations that did develop daring? And so you have a cultural change that leads to a biological change. And what I am fascinated in as well is how we understand biology in a cultural context. So when you have a population where most people have the mutation that allows them to drink milk, how does that then get elaborated in cultural institutions that, for example, promote milk as an ideal food or, you know, this kind of perfect food for humans?
And this hit especially close to home when her first son was born.
For example, when I would take my son to the pediatrician, and they, one of the questions they asked is, you know, what kind of milk is your child drinking? And I thought, well, that's an interesting way of asking that question. Not, why aren't you asking me, you know, what does your child drink, or does your child drink milk? Instead, it was assumed your child drank milk, and the question was simply what kind.
And the assumption is that not only do all kids drink dairy milk, but that milk is essential to helping them grow into healthy adults.
I think many of us heard that phrase growing up, that you have to drink your milk in order to grow. And so I was surprised when I started working on this about 10 years ago to find that there was actually very little written on this topic. It was a cultural assumption that didn't seem to have a strong scientific or body of evidence supporting it. I will say that there's absolutely no evidence at this point that calcium itself is what is making children grow. There are a number of calcium supplementation studies that don't show any impact on growth.
This idea that milk helps kids grow taller is part of what she's currently studying in India, where, like the U.S., dairy is an important part of the culture.
Milk has a complex cultural status there as well, and certainly in the Indian context, where you have a majority Hindu population, the cow is a sacred animal. At the same time, most of the milk in India actually comes from buffalo, who are not or do not have sacred status.
She's been following a group of children for 6 years to try to understand how milk relates to kids' growth. We'll have to talk to her again when that project is published.
So we asked her for a takeaway about milk's place in our culture. And she said, despite its importance to some of us, it is not necessarily essential to a nutritious diet.
Right. We have to look at the evidence and also consider the influences. She made a point of saying that the dairy industry has been very successful in overseeing child nutrition programs.
Mm-hmm.
But milk remains a fixture in our food culture, and Andrea's work explores why. Bottom line, milk is an especially interesting food, both biologically and culturally.
As an anthropologist, I think a close and holistic examination of particular foods actually tells us a great deal about ourselves. Milk just happens to be this phenomenal example, I think, because there's such a strong biological component to it that maps onto, you know, human biological variation, and there's an interesting evolutionary story around it.
Which brings to mind, Annie, that Andrea has a project in the works on another rather special food at the intersection of biology and culture. Gluten.
Oh, well, how timely is that?
I know.
Andrea Wiley has written two books about milk, Reimagining Milk, Cultural and Biological Perspectives, and Cultures of Milk, the Biology and Meaning of Dairy Products in the United States and India. Andrea Wiley there was speaking with our two guests, Maddie Chera and Lee Bush, who are doctoral students at Indiana University's Anthropology of Food program. Thanks for coming in, you guys.
Thanks so much, Annie.
Coming up, it's Into the Kitchen with chefs Daniel Orr and Bob Atkins. Last week, we gave you vegan recipes for a sauce and a burger, and that's how every show in January is going to work. A condiment and a main dish made with zero animal products. Your ingredients will include saffron, tofu, walnuts, and Napa cabbage leaves. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net.
I'm going to take you guys at Earth Eats on a trip to the south of France today, where it's the land of Rouy. Rouy is the old French dialect, or called Provençal, for rust. So this is kind of a rust-colored sauce, and most traditionally known as the accompaniment to bouillabaisse, which is the classic Marseillaise fish soup, which has, you know, about 15 or 20 different kinds of fish and shellfish in it. One of the bases of the dish, which gives it part of its color, is saffron. And what we're going to do today, you can see they're like little filaments, little hairs. We're going to take a little bit of hot water, and we're going to pour that on top. And you can see how that yellow comes out right away. And we're going to let that steep in there for a few minutes. Now today, instead of the classic, which takes a lot of oil, we are going to use some tofu in this that I've diced up. I'm going to use about a half a pound. And to that, I'm going to add some garlic. It's going to be raw, so it's going to be quite strong. Okay, we're going to add 1/2 russet potato that we've cooked and scooped out of the skin. And that's going to help give us the thickness and give the body to the rouy. And now we're going to start building the flavors. So I'm going to add some chili powder. And then we're going to add about 10 drops of Tabasco. Give us a little more heat. Since we are using that tofu, we're going to need less oil. Usually it's about, to this amount, it would be about 2 cups of oil. So we're only going to use about 3 tablespoons. I'm going to add 1/2 of a medium-sized tomato. And then finally, you can see how that saffron has really perfumed out to a nice orange-yellow color. That real floral aroma, we're going to dump that in with the water. Okay, and I'm going to start this on low. Increase the speed up. Turn it off and give it a stir. Perfect. Put it in the fridge and use it whenever we want. I think you'll come up with 101 ways to use this.
Make sure I got everything in place.
Now here's Chef Bob Atkins.
Okay. Everybody loves tacos, I think. Most people love tacos. You can put whatever you want on them. They can be gourmet. They can be as cheap as you want. Today we're going to do a little spin on tacos, and we're going to make raw, vegan Napa tacos. Okay? But these are real fun and super simple. Again, very few ingredients. What I have here are some nice walnuts. Toss the raw nuts into the bowl of the food processor. If you want to, you can toast them. As Chef D has pointed out a lot, toasting brings out a lot of the flavors of nuts. But since we're making raw tacos, we're going to leave them untoasted. Okay, into that we're gonna add a little powdered garlic, maybe 2 tablespoons of really nice fresh chili powder that hasn't been sitting in the back of your cabinet for 2 years. You know who you are, spice people. We're gonna put about maybe 2 teaspoons of freshly ground cumin. Again, you could toast the cumin, but we haven't toasted it since these are entirely raw. Okay, nice little pinch of salt. Nice little pinch of pepper. You can put some cayenne in here if you like it to be a little spicy, but these will keep a little mild. And then some extra virgin olive oil. We're just gonna pulse the walnuts and the spices together. You don't wanna really make a paste. You know, taco meat is crumbly, but it's small. So we're just gonna...
It really does look like ground beef.
It really does, and you're going to be surprised how much like a meat taco this does taste. Since we're not gonna use anything that's cooked, instead of using a tortilla that's been fried or pressed, we're going to use, once again, some handy dandy Napa cabbage leaves. We've used these a lot. They make great vehicles for all your stuffing needs. You could use endive barquettes and make barquettes out of little boats. So just kind of find some nice fresh Napa cabbage, nice and pale, inner leaves. Sprinkle the nut meat inside the Napa leaves. And then I like to top it with some freshly made pico de gallo. Pico de gallo, you know, tomatoes, red onion, jalapenos, a little lime juice. Again, real simple. I know, I think tofu's processed under heat, but we can also use a tofu sour cream that we make using silken tofu and firm tofu. Leave it off if you like. So once you have that, you can put some whole cilantro on there. You could put some jalapenos. You could put cheese on there if you wanted to. It doesn't have to be vegan. You could put sour cream, you know, roasted peppers, whatever you want on there. The world is your oyster when it comes to these tacos. The bottom line is they are very easy, and I think you'd have a hard time telling the difference between that and a regular meat taco.
Here we go. Oh, you're right.
It tastes like a taco, right?
Is there a reason that you selected walnuts over another nut? I'm curious.
Walnuts, they have a good flavor. It's kind of neutral. It takes to a lot of other ingredients, like with the chili powder and stuff. They're not super expensive. Nuts are expensive in general, and they just have a really good texture. Once they're put with some olive oil, it has a nice meaty kind of ground beef like texture.
Thank you, Chef Bob.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Genuinely, these taste like the real thing, and the texture is really wonderful. This recipe and the recipe for the Rui are on our website. I'm also glad to say that we're now posting select recipes from PBS Food. The one that just went online is a kale and farro breakfast bowl. Add an egg on top of that if you like. Check in with eartheats.org every day to see what's new. Shout out to our staff, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla and Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr and all his folks at Farm Bloomington, the reporters at Harvest Public Media, and Lee Bush and Maddie Chera from Indiana University's Food Institute are now on the Earth Eats team. So great to bring them on board. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.